This is Front Page Sunday. I'm Todd Hatton.
And I'm Chad Lampe. Kentucky lawmakers get to work on Tuesday with the start of the 2013 legislative session. Kentucky Public Radio Capitol Bureau Chief Kenny Colston will cover the session for us. He joins me from Louisville to run down the top agenda items for this session. Kenny, thanks very much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Before things get too busy, we'd like to sit and talk about what's happening or what's going to happen in this legislative session. It is a short session, though, so there won't be any budget activity, right?
No, that's correct. Probably very little, unless they have to reopen a budget somehow for this pension mess that they're in. But we're not talking about large-scale budget negotiations here.
Then the biggest issue will be the state pension system and pension reform. What kind of conversations are you hearing now about what may happen?
Well, the conversations now are, how do you pay for this unfunded liability, as they call it, that's in the hundreds of billions of dollars? As we hear the governor say, he's balanced the budget 11 times now. They put Medicaid in pretty much a private system to help balance the state budget. There's not a lot of want to issue a bond because, as you know, state universities, a lot of their bonds got rejected this last budget cycle. So that's where the debate is going to be. Lawmakers are pretty much agreed, both House Speaker Greg Stumbo and Majority Floor Leader in the Senate, Republican Damon Thayer, on the task force, their recommendations to fully fund what's called the ARC, the actuarial required contribution every year, what the General Assembly has to pay. There's agreement that that should be fully funded. There's agreement that new hires should pretty much be in what's called a hybrid cash balance system, which is part old pension, part 401k. That's kind of the easy stuff. And they'll have to put those recommendations into law. But the big thing is how to pay for it. And there's not agreement on that. There's not agreement on whether you cut more spending. There's not agreement on whether or not you float a bond. And that's what lawmakers are going to have to wrestle over in the 30 days they have. There's agreement that the pension system is broken. How do you fix it?
So it seems like a pretty big issue. Could you even speculate on whether or not you think that's going to get done?
I think it will. I think it has to. It's almost like when this past session, when they had the unemployment insurance issues, if they don't do something about it, the problem's only going to get worse. And if they let it get worse, you're talking about possible pension system bankruptcy, at which point you're talking about, is there city bankruptcies because cities pay into this? Is there state bankruptcy? And that's a topic that you can't even touch on, because how can a state go bankrupt? Who bails out a state in bankruptcy? So this has come to the table. They know they have to deal with this now. It's gotten too big. The question is how do they pay for it? Some people have said tax reform. The governor's tax reform commission has all these revenues that if they implemented the full thing, although that seems unlikely, maybe a few tweaks to the tax system. Some people have even suggested that expanded gaming revenues could possibly help pay for the pension system, although not many lawmakers are talking about that. That's what it comes down to.
Another issue that we've reported on here, since Murray has recently and a couple other communities in our listening area have allowed liquor sales through referendum, is that the state may look at reforming liquor laws too. Explain the reasoning for this.
Well, the reasoning is that a federal judge has pretty much vacated a lot of the current liquor laws. He struck them down as not fair. You have your freestanding liquor stores. You have places like pharmacies, like your Walgreens and your CVS, that can sell beer and wine, and I believe small quantities of spirits. But your grocery stores, your Walmarts, your Krogers, even your small ones, they can really only sell beer. And a federal judge has said that's not fair. So he vacated all the laws. Luckily, that he also stayed his ruling until after the General Assembly can write new laws. And what they're going through right now is figuring out pretty much how to rewrite the law to match what they had without basically having the judge throw out the new law almost immediately. House Speaker Greg Stumbo says he interprets the ruling that there needs to be uniformity. If CVS can sell wine in small doses of spirits, then Kroger should be able to as well. If Kroger can't do it, then CVS or Walgreens shouldn't be able to do it. So the question is are we going to have gas stations that can sell bourbon and can sell wine and it's a free-for-all and could possibly put your neighborhood liquor store out of business? not a lot of people want that because they don't want young kids being able to go into gas stations and buying Maker's Mark. There's a little bit more protections, I guess, when you look at your average liquor store. But that's what they're going to have to work through. The problem is that they are pretty much, as far as I know, at ground zero. The people who are protecting the liquor stores and even protecting kids, education groups, they haven't really come to the proposal that Speaker Stumbo says he thinks could survive the judge's ruling. So they're going to have to work through that as well. I think that's going to be an issue that will go below the table while they're dealing with pensions. But if they don't come up with a law, then it will be a free-for-all. You will have gas stations that can sell wine and liquor.
What about, you mentioned possibly paying for some of the pension deficits with expanded gaming revenue if expanding gaming is passed. Do you think it's going to get another chance this session?
It's really weird. I originally did not think so, even with the departure of State Senate President David Williams, because there's a lot of Republicans in the Senate who just don't like the idea of expanded gaming. But there's been reports that the Courier-Journal recently reported that Governor Steve Beshear is open to an amendment that does not protect the horse industry. And if there's an amendment in the Senate that doesn't have specific constitutional protections for any industry in Kentucky, I believe that probably has the votes to pass. The biggest problem with the gambling bill this last go-around was that 60-mile rule that you couldn't have any casino within 60 miles of a racetrack. That knocks out areas like, I believe, Murray, because Paducah has a racetrack. Owensboro would be knocked out because of Ellis Park and Henderson. And a lot of lawmakers weren't happy about that. If you get a clean bill, I think it's pretty close that it would pass. The question is how much does the horse industry throw a fit? Tracks like Keeneland who want protections, do they throw a fit and try to kill an amendment through Democratic votes that doesn't protect them?
Also, you've been covering this quite extensively, and that is the legalization of hemp as industrial hemp for manufacturing processes and for farmers in the Commonwealth. You've got the Agriculture Commissioner standing behind this. You've also got one of the U.S. Senators for Kentucky standing behind this. Do you think that's enough support to move lawmakers to vote on a bill and legalize hemp in Kentucky, industrial hemp?
I think the hemp bill will probably be able to get through the Senate. Now that there's a new Senate agriculture chairman, Senator Paul Hornback, who's a big ally of Commissioner Comer, I think it definitely gets through committee and probably gets through the whole Senate. The question is on the House side, the biggest roadblock is the Kentucky State Police, who say they do not support the legalization of industrial hemp. They say that they can't tell the difference between hemp and marijuana when they do their raids, and that it's just too costly to try to get more people, more boots on the ground during these raids, too expensive to send the plants back to testing to their labs. And so they would just rather not have it. That's the roadblock for Speaker Stumbo. That appears to be the roadblock for Governor Steve Beshear. If they can somehow get the Kentucky State Police to back off, this is an easy law for them to pass. But I definitely think it gets through the Senate. And Commissioner Comer used to be a House member. So it's a question of whether he can convince enough Democrats who control that chamber that this isn't a bad thing, that this can create revenue, this can help tobacco farmers who will see their tobacco buyout money run out here in a few years. If not this year, I think 2014 is a definite year for it.
We talked with retired Senator Ken Winters here of Murray, who was the chair of the Education Committee in the Senate. Do you have a sense of who will succeed him in that role?
Yes, his successor will be Mike Wilson, state senator from Bowling Green. He's actually still considered a freshman. As you know, Senator Winters left, Senator Vernie McGahey, and Senator Jack Westwood, three people who have been on that committee a long time, and a lot of knowledge was lost in that. So Wilson kind of has his work cut out for him. I don't expect too many crazy things to come through that. I think charter schools is resting for a while now that you have districts of innovation. It seems like the biggest thing that could come through is if Speaker Stumbo tries to pass a U-Pike, bringing that into the state system again, cementing the dropout age at 18. But I kind of have a feeling that Senator Wilson might take a session, and an odd year session is a great time to do this, and kind of get his feet wet now that they've lost that much experience.
And Paducah Senator Bob Leeper, who's the only independent in the state Senate, but caucuses with the Republicans, had a failed bid to be the Senate president, and he was beaten by Senate President-elect Stivers. Are there any hard feelings between Senator Leeper and Stivers?
Not that I can tell. Senator Leeper is still the chairman of the Appropriations and Revenue Committee, which is the best committee to be on, and the chairmanship, that's practically part of leadership to be on that. You control the budget. And so he's still chairman of that committee. He's actually, and this was a surprise to me, while he's caucused with Republicans for a while now, he actually wasn't a full caucus member. He basically got to sit in and listen to the meetings. And Senator Stivers, you know, with a vote of the caucus, has now made Senator Leeper a full member of the caucus. He gets to vote. He's not just listening there, twiddling his thumbs anymore. So I don't think there's any bad blood there. Senator Leeper's been around for a while. He's a really great guy. A lot of people, you know, work well with him in Frankfort. You don't hear a lot of nasty things about him from either side. And so I think that hatchet is probably buried. I would be surprised if there's any lingering anger in the coming session.
Capitol Bureau Chief Kenny Colston will have a busy 30 days beginning on Tuesday with the start of the general session of the Kentucky Legislature. Kenny, thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Just ahead, a conversation with Kentucky Department of Education's Lisa Gross, who retired after almost 30 years with the Commonwealth. Then we'll talk with an area entrepreneur who's working to expand educational opportunities for students in far western Kentucky when Front Page Sunday from WKMS News returns. This is Front Page Sunday. I'm Chad Lampe.
And I'm Todd Hatton. Kentucky Department of Education Communications Division Director Lisa Gross retired last month. Gross has been with the department for 27 years. Earlier in 2012, she earned the Kevin M. Noland Award for significant service to the Commonwealth's public schools. Gross has been responsible for KDE's public information and media relations. For many Kentucky education reporters, Gross has been the go-to person at the state level. Before retiring, Gross joined Angela Hatton from her office to talk about how Kentucky education has changed over the years.
You've been with the Kentucky Education Department through more than one major education reform, which is one reason I wanted to speak with you, because you've kind of seen from the policy end of it how the state has worked to actually change how we educate our students. When you first came to the department, it was right before CARA was passed. Explain to me what Kentucky Education Department was like in the late 80s, early 90s.
Sure, it was much different. And, you know, the world was a lot different in those days. I can remember being thrilled that we had IBM Selectric typewriters that would correct before they typed things on the page. And now I'm not sure that I could even find a typewriter in the building. We've moved from actual typing to word processing and email and working in the cloud and those sorts of things. So the actual technology that we use is a lot different, but the agency itself is very different. When I first started working here, we had an elected superintendent of public instruction, and that had been the case in Kentucky since about the mid-1800s, where we had someone who was elected by the population to basically oversee public schools. Well, that all changed about 4 years after I started working here with the passage of the Kentucky Education Reform Act in 1990. Prior to 1990, I think things were sort of lumping along. Schools really were sort of doing their own thing. We had issues with funding and finance. We didn't really have a good, strong curriculum in place. The management of some school systems wasn't great, but you found pockets of good throughout the states, just like you do now. So when CARA came into play, though, things became a lot more consistent. For one thing, CARA really had an impact on funding. That was one of the primary things that CARA looked at was funding, and that's one of the main changes that happened. And what I saw was a lessening of the inequities across the state. In the past, where you lived in Kentucky had a direct impact on the kind of education that you got in the public school system. So if you lived in a rural area or you lived in an area that maybe was a little poorer than its neighbors, your educational experience would suffer as a result 9 times out of 10. When CARA came into being, though, that changed quite dramatically because CARA's finance requirements were designed to sort of level the playing field across the state. So it didn't matter where you lived. It didn't matter that you might live in a place that had a bad economy or had low property taxes or not a lot of business and industry. State funding would help make up the difference for what your local economy might lack. And that really did help level the playing field for students across the state so that students had access to resources like textbooks and technology and the things that they needed, and teacher salaries could be a little more competitive than they used to be. And then the curriculum part of CARA, too, was something really new. We don't necessarily mandate curriculum at the state level, but what we do is design core curriculum connected to our state assessment. And so teachers can use that to design what they do in the classroom on a daily basis. We're certainly not monitoring teachers as they actually teach in the classroom every single day because we trust them to do their work and do it well. But now we provide sort of a roadmap for them, and they can align their curriculum to what's going to be tested in the core subjects. And that doesn't mean that they can't teach anything else. It just means that they have a good, strong spine to their curriculum.
Yeah.
And then as far as school management goes, which was the other big component of CARA, that's changed dramatically. Before CARA, we'd never heard of something like school-based decision making. It didn't really appear on our radar at all. We couldn't even get our heads around the concept that maybe there would be a group of people, parents and teachers and the principal, in a school that could actually make decisions about how that school was run on a day-to-day basis. But CARA brought that into play. And so now the majority of our public schools have school-based decision-making councils that involve a lot of people, whether they're actually on the council or they serve on committees. And they're making decisions that are very important to the running of the school and how that school provides instruction to students. I think that CARA was probably the biggest change that I had seen, at least up until 2009, with the passage of Senate Bill 1.
Another thing that's a big part of your job is pushing out the data and the information on the state's test scores, on school facility plans, all of those kinds of things.
Right.
How has education data and the amount of data changed in Kentucky?
Oh, it's changed dramatically. And again, that goes back to access and technology and that sort of thing. But there's also been a better attitude about sharing data. It used to be that it was, it was like pulling teeth to get data from people. But we are in a data-driven society now. And so this idea of being accountable simply by providing data took root in the early 90s, and it really is sort of a given now. We just expect that that's going to happen. In a lot of cases, numbers tell so many stories, and there's always a concern that somebody's going to use data for incorrect purposes or maybe, tweak it a little bit to match their own perceptions, but it tells a lot of stories. And, an example of that is the data that we collect on students that are eligible for free and reduced price meals. You can look at that data and you can make inferences about the economy. You can look at that data and make inferences about how well students might perform on tests, because we know that there's an achievement gap between students who are considered low income and students who aren't. So those numbers, and that's really what they are very important when you're making policy decisions and when you're planning for the future.
And as a state or as a commonwealth, Kentucky has sort of suffered nationally from a reputation of sometimes being the backward state, you know, everybody's barefoot. But do you feel like as far as education goes, that has changed over the years?
Oh, I do think it's changed. People in Kentucky probably don't know that. But what happens now is, and this really started happening after CARA was passed and we started seeing some results from that, people from other states are hungry for knowledge about how we do what we do. And I travel a little bit in this position, and I've been to conferences in Washington and other places with people from other states, and they are drawn to me because they know where I'm from, and they pepper me with questions. How did you do this? How did Kentucky manage to have one of the best fourth grade reading scores on the National Assessment of Educational Progress of any state, not just southern states, not just, you know, states of a certain population, any state in the country? How did you manage to do all of the things that you've done relative to finance and funding? How have you managed to get legislation through that other states have struggled with? So we're held up as a model by other states. It's hard to see that when you live here sometimes because people are so used to the status quo and they don't think that things are moving forward. But we really are a model. And, you know, as a Kentuckian, I get very, very defensive when we're referred to as a backward state. That's not the case at all. We're doing very well here. I think we're going to continue to do well. And there's going to come a time when Kentucky's not in that group of states that is picked on as far as being poor or being backward.
Kentucky Department of Education Communications Division Director Lisa Gross, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
High unemployment and low graduation rates have been a problem for the far western Kentucky counties of Fulton, Hickman, and Carlisle for many years. One area businessman, though, is attempting to break that tradition by providing education opportunities for local students. Shelley Baskin speaks with former Kentucky Executive Cabinet Secretary and local businessman Robbie Rudolph about his role in shaping the future of the area's students.
You've been involved in the Four Rivers Scholarship Foundation. It's something that you've been leading for a little bit. Could you tell me a little bit about the programs and what the Scholarship Foundation's been doing over there?
What we did, Shelley, is we looked at the economic depression that we have in far western Kentucky. And I'm originally from Fulton City, graduated from Fulton City High School. And I looked at what ways we could bring it back. So what we did, I called the superintendent, Diane Owen, of Fulton City and talked to her about what needs and things. And I wanted to bring it back through education. So what we did with the K through 4, we give them every kid a free book. And what I found out was that over half those kids have never received a book. They never owned a book. And when I was a kid, I had a dozen Dr. Seuss books, you know. So we set up a whole program and said, look, we're going to do this. And then the 5th and 6th grades, we want to have a career fair. And I want them to understand what area they need to be in. You know, maybe health sciences, not necessarily to be a doctor or a nurse, but, you know, maybe work in the labs or something. And then welding or a beautician or selling tires, whatever. And so we bring all these professionals in from service managers of dealerships to welders to EMTs to give them an idea and put in the gymnasium. It's really amazing how these 5th and 6th graders soak this up. The 7th and 8th graders, we take to the area technical centers. And I think the rubber meets the road in this area in far western Kentucky. And so we look at welders and IT and health sciences and all of that. That we have some very successful ATCs. We have a great one here in Murray and have a great one over in Fulton County in Hickman and the one in Mayfield. And then in the 7th and 8th grades, we take them around and look at take them to the area technical centers. In the 9th and 10th grade, we take to the universities and give them an idea of what the life is. And then the 10th and 11th, or the 11th and 12th grades, we take, we have a dual credit program. And Randy Dunn and Murray State have been unbelievably supportive. I can go down the list, but, you know, Gina Winchester, Charlotte Bradshaw, Dr. Duncan, Dr. Cox, Dr. Rose, all these people have helped us form this. And we now have about 3,000 dual credit hours being taken by the 11th and 12th graders of those four schools. And it's been just a great success. So with the guarantee that they're going to go to college and now having 15 to 30 hours in their pocket, they go back home and say, what do you mean I can't go to college? I've got 15 college credit hours. I have it paid for, and I'm going. And that's been working.
And is this something where you keep track of the students as they make their way through college?
Yeah, we do. Let's say if it's a $2,000 scholarship check, they come back four times a year to get a $500 check. They have to come back to the high school. They have to go back to the guidance counselor. And then to get to see all their peers, the younger peers, and I want one to influence the other, if you will, and get a pat on the back and all that. And that seems to be working real well also. And then we track that. They sign a release with us. We follow their attendance. We follow their grades. Now, you're going to have kids that will drop out for different reasons. And they may be out a semester. They may be out two semesters. But we follow them and try to get them back, and we get them back. I guess they quit 6 or 10 times. I'm still going to take them back. I just want them to be in school, and they have a lot of challenges at home, and we look past all of that.
And how else are you supporting these students? Is this something where you're encouraging them to kind of explore their options and maybe find something that they really enjoy and they can stick with for a while?
Well, and that's what we do with the career fair. I really believe that we need to get them early, if you will. And I have, you know, some kids say that I want to be a doctor, but then they pass out when they see blood. But they may want to be a hospital administrator.
Mm-hmm.
I was speaking to a class one time, and I asked that question, you know, what do you want to be when you grow up? And we were all asked that 1,000 times. And this little girl, the first one that answered said, I'd like to be a librarian. Well, nothing against librarians, but everybody in the class, you know, you heard this sigh. And I said, well, that's great. That means you like to read, you like to research, you like to study. You could go to work for a large corporation and do a lot of research because a lot of executives and stuff, they don't want to do that kind of work. And then the kids, you could see their light bulb go off. Well, that made me think to have these career fairs to bring in a service manager of a Toyota dealership, which Dwayne Taylor, by the way, sends one every time to one of the to our career fairs, all the career fairs. And they get an idea of just the car business, the cars, not necessarily taking the engines apart, but being interested in cars. And we bring in hairdressers. We bring in EMTs. We have an EMT program that we sponsor. We have a CNA program, which is Certified Nursing Assistants, where these kids, when they graduate from high school, they immediately go to work in a nursing home, and then hopefully we map those into a nursing program. My wife is a nurse, has a master's degree in nursing, and she's very interested in that. So things like that, to just give them an idea and a promise of hope that they'll be able to attain it.
And most of these programs, it seems that you're fairly successful at making some real change. What direction do you want to see this go in the future? Is this something you want to see other areas try to get people who might not necessarily be a school administrator involved and interested in the education of their area's children?
Yeah, I'd like to. What we want, I hope for, is non-academia people to be involved, like my wife and I have, and some of our other board members, and to come in and really help and give it the real world advice to come in and work with academia and to advance those school districts, and which, of course, will advance the region. Kentucky lacks in so many areas, and you know, unfortunately, we're ranked at the bottom of a lot of things. And we're very fortunate living here in Murray, Callaway County. we have a lot of involvement, a lot of family involvement, a lot of encouragement, and the schools do well, and of course we've got a fantastic university here, and that makes for a great place for these kids to come and see the success. But our region's not going to come back with just Murray State. It takes collaboration between Murray State and Paducah and Lyon County, Crittenden County, Coel County, and then go all the way back over to the rivers to Ballard, Carlisle, Fulton, and Hickman, and Graves, and working all that together, and then bringing people, the business people, with the academia, and bringing everybody on the same page. I think that's how, matter of fact, I'm pretty sure that's the only way we're going to bring this region back to where it needs to be.
Robbie and Lisa Runoff are the founders of the Four River Scholarship Foundation program, and I appreciate you coming in.
Thank you for taking the time.
Jerry Penner has headed Murray-Calloway County Hospital for 2 years now, and when we come back, we'll speak with him about the challenges presented by a changing healthcare landscape in western Kentucky. We'll also take a look at Racer basketball with Neil Bradley. This is Front Page Sunday from WKMS News.
You're listening to Front Page Sunday. I'm Chad Lampe.
And I'm Todd Hatton. Murray-Calloway County Hospital CEO Jerry Penner has headed the local healthcare provider for 2 years now. One of his main priorities has been improving quality of care. In 2012, MCCH was among Kentucky hospitals struggling with financial problems related to changes in the state's healthcare system. And recently, Penner was one of five Kentucky hospital leaders who met with Governor Steve Beshear to discuss slow reimbursements and the high claim denial rate from the state's Medicaid managed care organizations. Angela Hatton speaks with Penner about how healthcare continues to change in our region.
You said that you felt that Governor Beshear did listen to the hospital CEOs when you met with them. Do you feel that means that there will be changes to the MCO system?
Well, I think the real challenge here was he had to listen to what he was hearing. We were represented from CEOs across the state. That was anything from 25-bed critical access hospitals to the largest hospital of St. Elizabeth's with 480 beds. So we're somewhere right in the center of that. And the real struggle has been cash flow coming from our managed care organizations or the MCOs. Medicaid changed here in the state in November of last year, and we went to, rather than be a state-run organization or program, it became they contracted it out. So three managed care organizations, much like what they were doing with the Passport region in Louisville and the surrounding counties, became statewide. So three of those came in, began managing that, and one of our big challenges has been getting that cash flow from them for services that we've already provided. That was the main gist of our conversation, but there were a lot of smaller things that we discussed while we were in there with the governor. And to the CEO, each one of us said the same thing. We're laying off personnel, we're closing services, because literally the cash flow is not happening here. Something we've relied on in the past. We shouldn't be fighting for state dollars. It's always been there for care that we're providing to the most impoverished folks that we have here in the community. We've always relied on that, and we'll be there to be able to help them out. All we want to do is be paid for that. So I think his brow was quite furrowed. He listened intently. What I think he will end up doing is talking with the MCOs and figuring out a way that we can make that cash flow happen for us.
And you mentioned layoffs. You know, you're referring to the 25 layoffs that MCCH recently had to do, as well as closing of a geriatric behavioral health unit, which had been one of the new services that the hospital was very proud to offer to the region. And offering new services and offering better quality care has been very important to the hospital here in Calloway County. Do you feel like in the future you're going to have to change your growth plan to, I guess, come in line with the actual resources that you have? What's the outlook on that?
Well, I think the real challenge here, and you go back to the geriatric behavioral health unit, when you have cash flow out there, and it's going well, and I use the Medicaid example. I mean, we're somewhere between $2 to $3 million short for services we provided. That's a ton of money for a small hospital this size. And if I'm able to pay salaries for that and benefits for that, great, I'll do that. And if you have that cash flow, the hospital board can make a decision to opt to have marginal services. Or even some cases, you keep services that are, well, let's call them losers. Losers from a financial standpoint, but it's good for the community. It keeps your patients from having to travel multiple counties away or, you know, hundreds of miles away to get the same care they can get here. So you'll say, we'll hold on to that product line because it's important. And if you can no longer sustain that, then you say, well, I've got to cut the marginal services out. I've got to go with our services that are, for lack of a better term, profitable. Even though I'm a not-for-profit hospital, we still have to have a margin to operate, to pay those benefits, to pay those salaries. And if I'm unable to do that, yeah, you'll have to make some hard decisions. And we've had to do that. And unfortunately, the GBH, the Geriatric Behavioral Health Unit, 25 wonderful people, I had to stare in the eye and say, I'm sorry, I cannot afford you anymore. It's a painful thing, knowing that not only did you lose the people right around here around the holidays and their families, and that's impactful, but then going back to how it impacts the service line and how far people have to travel now to get that same sort of care. Those are the issues that are confronting CEOs across the state, because we just don't have the cash flow. And I hate to, in this case, it is all about money. We've got to be smart businessmen as well. The hospitals just can't operate without dollars.
State of Kentucky recently got approval from the federal government to run its own state-based health benefit exchange system. And that's part of the healthcare reforms that are they're coming to the state. And are there any expectations from, you know, you as a local small hospital, regional hospital, on how that might affect you?
Well, a couple of reasons. It actually scares me to death. And I say that from the standpoint there are about half the states out there right now have basically said they're not going to start exchanges. Only five states that I know have been approved for the exchange. And again, by the time this airs, they're probably more than that. But I know half of them basically have said, no, we're not going to do the exchange, or we're going to let the government try to come in here, step in, and do the exchange for us. What that means for our state, and we have been one of those that have been approved, the guesstimates right now are an additional 560,000 people that will be covered under some sort of a healthcare plan that they didn't have formerly. Well, that's a challenge. And it's a challenge from the standpoint of reimbursements. If they come up, we have been told that the reimbursements may be much like Medicaid. Now, if the Medicaid reimbursements are the same, or if that's the level, I can already tell you it's a losing proposition for hospitals and for healthcare providers out there, because we do not get reimbursed based on cost. It's not the cost of production for what we're doing. It's a much lower cost. Matter of fact, the average across the board is about 75% in the state. So we're already taking here in this hospital, we range between 15 and 18% Medicaid. If we pick up another population out there with the same level of reimbursement, we're losing money. And I can't see, it may be good for the state, and it may be good for the folks that are being covered by care, but hospitals will lose money. And you couple that with all the cuts we're getting from the Affordable Care Act, it spells disaster for healthcare organizations and for physicians out there.
And this hospital is one of the few hospitals that has the system where it is government-owned, or is that the right language to use, government-owned or government-managed?
It's very very different. We are one of, I believe, one of 19 here in the state. There are 131 hospitals, and we are a city-county government hospital, which is, it's kind of unique. Most people, I love when they come up and say, well, you know, that's my taxpayer money at work, and I have to correct them and say, you know, we don't get any tax money from local patrons at all. So everything that we do here in this not-for-profit, government, city, county-owned hospital is based on the revenues that we generate.
Is that a system that you think you can continue going forward with the changes coming?
Well, yeah, I tell you, the folks out there, the deep pockets, the large systems out there are trying to consolidate as much as they can. They'll gobble up small hospitals like ours that may have some financial challenges. I think it's a model that can work. Again, there are several hospitals here in the state that still operate independently. And when you're a sole community hospital, much as like we are, or I say sole community because there's no other competition here within the city of Murray, it sets up a really difficult challenge when you go through changes in governmental regulations. It sets up challenges for us when it comes to payers, saying how much money are you going to get. If we have a bad year, I don't have a mothership basically to go and say, hey, help bail me out. So that's why it's difficult for I use the Medicaid example. We had a very difficult time last year with cash flowing there. Maybe a system, a multiple hospital system could have, one hospital's doing very well, it could share in the wealth to the hospitals that maybe aren't doing so well. So, yeah, I mean, we are certainly in danger of potentially one time being gobbled up, but I think if we do the right things now and make the right moves and stick with our core businesses, we won't have a problem of doing that. It's always a fear out there, though.
Do you think in the future that you could maybe hire back those 25 people that had to be let go? You know, not exactly maybe the same position, but as far as hospital growth, employee base, do you think that that's an outlook in the future?
Well, I think it all depends on the volumes. You know, we've got to be as smart as we possibly can here. We just did a strategic planning session, and we have for like a last 6-month period to put a facility master plan in place. and had some corporations come in and run some numbers and figures for us on where we think we're going for the future. And it did a couple things. It just didn't look at, well, it looked at our demographics for sure, but it also looked at the environment, at the healthcare environment. What are they going to be reimbursing us for? What do we think are going to be like with the different trends for surgery, for different outpatient surgeries, inpatient patient stays, lengths of stays, the impact that we're having from all the governmental regulations? What is that going to do to us? And we actually found that maybe we don't need 152 beds here anymore. Maybe 105 is probably the number. It might mean we contract a little bit more. So the real answer is we have to be as efficient as we can. Will we ever hire those folks back? I'd love to be able to do that. They were loyal to us before we had to lay them off. We'd love for them to be loyal to us again. Maybe not in that product line, but it's all based on volumes. If we have a year like last year, the real challenge was we didn't have a flu or pneumonia season. And our volumes across the state were down, I think across the state it was down about 12% inpatient, and we were down 11.3%. Why? Just didn't have the volumes. Some of it governmental, but this was one that was really environmental. So we'll have to see how healthcare continues to drive us. I do think our numbers will probably decline up until we figure out what the Affordable Care Act is going to do and what the final impact is going to be on it, both Medicare patients and what the exchanges are going to do, and just overall governmental oversight, because there's a whole lot of it out there.
Murray Callaway County Hospital CEO Jerry Penner, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Angie, thanks so much for allowing me to be here with you today, and hope I get a chance to do this again sometime.
Next up, Tracy Ross speaks with the voice of the Racers, Neil Bradley, for a recap of Murray State basketball in December and a look ahead to the rest of the 2012-13 season.
It's been a long time since we've talked. The holidays kind of have that time warp effect on you. We've actually missed a half dozen games, starting with Bethel, and the beginning of that slate looked pretty good for the Racers, but they've hit a bit of a speed bump over the last couple of games. So let's go back to Bethel and just start with that game, a fairly easy Racer win there.
Yeah, as it was supposed to be. You know, the Racers took care of business as they wanted to. You're supposed to win that one by a lot, and they did. And that was one of the few games where the Racers were able to play a lot of the freshmen. So we got to see significant minutes. At times they looked okay. At times they looked like freshmen, as you might expect. Part of the learning process. But the schedule really hasn't been friendly to allow those kind of games. And I think that's kind of hampered the development from the freshmen, at least to this point.
The next game was Evansville. The Racers did win that by 12, and that was the biggest margin of any of the other games we're going to talk about. How tough was Evansville in that game?
Evansville got off to a great start, led, I believe, by 12 points, a little over 6 or 7 minutes into the game. And things were looking bleak for the Racers. They weren't making shots. They weren't getting back on transition defense. They were allowing open threes. I know at the under 12 timeout, Coach Prohm went into the huddle, and I asked him after the game what he told him. He just said, guys, we're just going to start over. We're 8 minutes in. Let's just start from this point on and see what happens. Made it a close game at the half, took the lead early in the second half, never relinquished it. So a solid win, one of the best that the Racers have had this season.
Followed it up with Western, one of the games that the Racers love to win, and it was a really good game, but the Racers pulled that one out.
I know Western battling some injuries at the guard slots, but they had a couple of guys step up for them, as you might expect. They're a deep team. I mean, they're off to a 3-0 start in the Sun Belt as we're heading into this first weekend of 2013. But it was a tough game. Western battled hard. The Racers never could get that run going to pull away. I think a lot of that just with the Racers having to play the bench not conducive to having to play two or three players and pulling away. So anytime you have foul trouble, as the Racers had in the Western game, you're going to have to play freshmen. And Coach Prohm, I think, sometimes sees that to the detriment, at least in the early going. But, down the road, I think it's something that will pay off. But made the shots they needed to make to win. Isaiah Cannon played well in that one. Ed Daniel, a good game. And Brandon Garrett continued his really good play with another solid game against Western.
You follow that up with a win against Arkansas State. It wasn't an easy game, but they did prevail 61-54.
Yeah, that was one of those in person. Gosh, it was ugly by both teams. Racers didn't really play a great game offensively or defensively. Neither did Arkansas State. The numbers would reflect, it looks like they played very well defensively. But there's a ton of open shots missed in that one. But the Racers played well enough to win. Stacy Wilson didn't shoot the ball well. In fact, that sort of started a string of poor shooting for Stacy, which really consumed several games. But what he did do is rebound well. He had a double-double in that game, double figures in rebounds. And he, in fact, over his last five games, is averaging 7 rebounds a game. And out of the guard spot, that's simply amazing. Yet also over his last five games, he was shooting 21% from three-point range. So it seems to have he rebounds better, doesn't shoot as well. Hopefully he can get that balanced out at some point. But nevertheless, it was a good win in a tough environment. But fortunately, the Racers able to survive and get out of there with a victory. I think Coach Prohm said he was just glad to get out and get on to the next game.
That brings us up to the last couple of games, both of which the Racers ended up losing. I want to talk about Dayton and Valparaiso. Both of these programs have had really good teams in the past. This year's addition of those teams, are they classic Dayton and Valparaiso teams, or did the Racers just have off nights against tough competition?
No, they're really good teams. Dayton, even though I think they're picked middle of the pack in the A-10, I believe they're going to end up much better than that. And the Racers in a spot really to do well. They led by 5 at halftime, pushed the lead out a little further than that. But they had about a 3-minute stretch where they made poor decisions with the ball, didn't get back on transition defense, I thought made really bad shot decisions. And that little 3-minute stretch cost them, something that we didn't see much with the team last year. But we just have to get over last year's team. That was last year's team. This team is going to have to find its identity. And in that contest, I think we were able to see that this is a team that still has some flaws. The bench maybe still hasn't developed as they'd like. I know that seems to be a recurring theme with every game, but starting to get some good contributions. Even in that contest in the first half, we saw good contributions from Jeffrey Moss. So progress has been made. But Dayton's tough. Then you get on to the Valparaiso. This is a team that's picked to win the Horizon League. They won the Horizon League last year. It's a really good league. They're going to win 20 or more games this season. And you lost this game to a team that has 7 seniors on the roster. I mean, they are really deep, experienced. They have size, quickness, depth. Just added a guy. They really needed a little dose of quickness and speed, and they got that South Florida transfer, Doherty kid, that they just added to the lineup. And that has really helped them coming into the Racer game. In only 4 games, he'd average 15 points a game. So he's really given them quite a boost, and I think that'll show in their record for the rest of the season. But, I mean, they went to the Pit in New Mexico and I think lost by 1 possession out there. So to come into the CFSB Center, play the Racers as well as they did, and they, again, had that little stretch the Racers did where they didn't get it done, didn't get rebounds. Terrible rebounding day. One of the worst, I think, that we've seen in a while for the Racers. That's something they have to rectify, and they have to just make better decisions on their shots. We're seeing a little bit of that. I think Isaiah's forcing a few that maybe he normally wouldn't do that. He just feels the pressure, I think, to make the shots. Stacy doing the same thing. You know, he's a very confident kid. He feels if he's missed 5 in a row, he'll still make the next one. But I think they'll just have to reevaluate a little bit as to what they're going to do in that regard.
Putting the wins and losses behind us, did this non-conference schedule do what it needed to do to prepare the Racers for the OVC, now including Belmont, which has played a murderous schedule themselves?
Yeah, and I think that's the thing that is going to help, because now we can take a look at what the Racers are going to face from here on, and I'm not counting Belmont among them. They're really good. But there's not going to be a starting lineup that they will face other than the Bracket Buster game. We don't know who that'll be yet. That will have more talent on the floor than the Racers do. The bench, those freshmen who really struggle against an experienced bench at some of the better schools that we have played early on, are going to have a much better chance as they gain more experience as the season goes on against the OVC team. And I think you're going to notice a huge difference in that. There's about 5 teams right now, but one of them they don't have to be concerned about, Jacksonville State. They're ineligible due to some APR problems, so they will not be eligible. You think Tennessee State will be playing better. Belmont's been good. They're going to continue to be good. And Eastern Kentucky, I think, has been phenomenal to this point. They've been a bit of a surprise. Moorhead's run hot and cold, a bit of a cold streak right now, but I think they're capable of beating anybody as well in the OVC, and they could be kind of a dark horse later in the season.
Tracy Ross spoke with Neil Bradley, the voice of the Racers. The Murray State men's basketball team will host the Colonels of Eastern Kentucky University this Thursday at 7 o'clock at the CFSB Center. You've been listening to Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. Our correspondents are Drew Adams, Shelley Baskin, Angela Hatton, Whitney Jones, Casey Northcutt, and John Walker. Kate Lochte is a contributing producer, and Matt Markgraff provides website assistance.
We welcome your questions or comments about the stories you've heard today. You can email them to msu.wkmsnews@murraystate.edu, post them to our Facebook page, or tweet them to @WKMS. You can find links to all three at wkms.org. You can also hear any of today's features again. Thanks for listening.